Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
A few days ago, I posted a simple question on our Open House Community Facebook page. What's the key to love, life and leadership? Lots of good, thoughtful replies from Kerry, listening, David, otherness or service. Lynn says, self-sacrifice and wisdom. Cindy, gratitude and faith. Jonathan asked, chocolate? Michael said, Jesus. My next guest says, humility. It is such a simple word for such a simple virtue. We like humble people, sports people who behave sensibly and use their fame for the good of others, actors who speak deprecatingly of their own talents, leaders who understand their limitations and that the people they lead are more important than actually they are. I think they are all people we Australians are drawn to. But you may be surprised to learn that humility was not always seen as a great virtue. Rather, it was once seen as something to be despised. What changed? How do we, as everyday Australians, see humility now? How does it play out for good in our lives, in love, and revealingly in leadership? John Dixon should know all about humility. He wrote the book on it, and no doubt he's a very humble man. John Dixon, welcome back to Open House.
I was dreading that sort of interview.
Sorry, I could hardly resist.
I know. I wrote to the publisher just before it was to be printed, and I said, you know, stop press, let's change the title to Humility and How I Achieved It.
It's a work in progress for us all.
So, you know, how do you write a book on humility without sounding like an arrogant jerk?
Too well, right.
I couldn't resolve that dilemma, so I thought I'd just sound like an arrogant jerk.
Good on you. John's book is called Humilitas, A Lost Key to Life, Love and Leadership. We're kicking off a four-part series on our first Open House for 2012 on this simple yet powerful virtue with quite a history, John. As I said, you know all about it. Describe to me in your terms, having looked at it so intently, how do you define humility?
Humility, correctly defined, is to hold your power for the good of others before yourself. Mm. So whether that's power physically, intellectually, financially, in terms of beauty, whatever it is that you have, it's to orient it toward other people rather than using it for yourself. So it's not really about avoiding being praised or avoiding people thinking highly of you. Modesty is the word for that sort of stuff. But okay, humility is a different word. It has to do with actually how you act toward other people using your power for their good.
And the word humilitas from the Latin actually differs a little from our modern usage.
Well, humilitas, the word when it was used in ancient Latin, meant lowly or to be crushed. It had very negative connotations. The word actually means lowly. The etymology is you know, low to the ground. And it was used generally by Greeks and Romans to mean the sort of the way a slave might act. Lowly, demeaned, put down.
Yeah.
We have now, because of the evolution of the word, come to use it in a positive way. We hardly ever use humility of the negative state of being put low. We use the word humiliation for that,
yes,
which also comes from the same Latin word.
Yeah.
It's just that there's been a shift in meaning over time.
Why do you think it was so scorned in the ancient world?
Because the ancient world loved honor and despised shame. So an ancient family thought principally about how we can bring honor to our family name. And your hope for your children was that they would honour you by the way they acted in public, and that they would honour themselves and pass on that family honour. And the greatest harm you could possibly experience in the ancient world was to be publicly shamed. Mm. So to put yourself beneath another person was to give up your honour. And that was just too much. So this word that we now use in a positive sense wasn't used in a positive way prior to the Christian period.
I was just going to say, the great turning point was Jesus. Radical in so many ways, but especially in this concept of humility.
We get a couple of hints before Jesus in Jewish literature. So in the Old Testament, there are a couple of references to the humble whom God loves. And there it really means the crushed, those who have been humbled, yes, by the powerful people. But the twist is God actually really loves those sorts of people and will lift up the lowly. So there's the word. It's the humble word. And so already in Jewish culture, you have a belief that God actually prefers the lowly, that he's actually on their side and looking to lift them up. But it really isn't until Jesus that you get the very strong ethical encouragement to act lowly toward someone who's your peer. And so it really is just an historical statement that's not that controversial, even outside theological circles.
Yes.
To say Jesus changed the way Westerners think about power and humility.
But if I take my mind back to then, here he comes with this concept that turns so much on its head. That was a really radical and challenging idea for people to get their heads around.
Incredibly. And it took more than just Jesus teaching about humility, although he on occasion says things that sound very humble, like whoever wants to be great must be the least, must be the slave. That's how you become great. So they are very humble sounding teachings, but that wasn't enough. Really what changed things is his death on a cross, because that confronted his ancient followers with a very serious question. Were we wrong about how great Jesus was? I mean, we thought he was the best thing going, and he ended up on the most shameful place in the Roman world. He was naked and crucified, and this was a death reserved for the lowest of the low. So they're asking themselves, was he not as great as we thought? Or do we have to redefine greatness to include the willingness to shame yourself, lower yourself for the sake of another? And of course they opted for the latter, because they couldn't bring themselves to believe that he wasn't as great. So suddenly they had to think of greatness as actually including the idea of sacrificing your honor and status and power for the good of others, even if those others are your lessers. See, in the ancient world, you could be humble toward an emperor. That just made sense, right? You lower yourself before an emperor, because they could kill you, right? And they were better than you in the way ancient Romans thought. But to lower yourself before an equal, or to lower yourself before a lesser, was unthinkable until the crucifixion. And by the end of the first century, this word humility is being used by Christians to mean one of the principal ways you are to act. You are to lower yourself. And Westerners have inherited that, which is not to say you need to be a Christian in order to appreciate humility. You don't now. But the reality is our Western world has been shaped by that story, whether you believe that story or not.
How long did it take to really sweep through Western thinking and Western behavior?
Centuries.
Yes.
So it is clearly talked about by Christians from the middle of the first century. And we have some beautiful phrases from the Apostle Paul where he says, in humility, regard others as better than yourselves. Have this mind that was in Christ, though being very nature God, emptied himself, humbled himself to become man and died on the cross, right? So you get that language there. But by the end of the first century, we have some Christian documents, not in the New Testament, that talk about humility all the time. So Christians have taken humility on as a key virtue by the end of the first century. It's really centuries after that that humility started to become the norm. And really, we can probably date it to the 4th and 5th centuries when Constantine, the emperor, becomes a Christian. And Christian values tend to be normalized now as good Roman values, because we now think Jesus is emperor. Oh, as soon as you think Jesus is emperor, you've got to go with that idea that the emperor is one who gave himself on a cross for you. So you've got humility, whether you like it or not.
Yeah. Okay, let's fast forward to today. In your book, you talk about some fascinating research into some of the world's top companies. So going to the corporate world, apparently there is such a thing as a truly great company, but just a few of them. Coca-Cola, Johnson & Johnson, General Electric, Gillette. So can we go to Gillette? What made that get the cut, if you pardon the pun?
Yeah.
What was it about Gillette that made it a truly great company?
The research was done by Jim Collins, who's a very famous business academic from Stanford University. And it's in his book. The research is written up in the book Good to Great, so anyone can buy that and have a look at it for themselves. But he had this very stringent test for a great company, and that is they had to outperform the market by three times over a 15-year period. So bottom line. So this is a company that went from, you know, being normal to outperforming the general market by 3 times in terms of revenue, and pulled it off for a decade and a half. And so only 11 companies in American history entered that. And then he did a very serious analysis of the kinds of leaders that led all of those companies, and found that in all 11 good to great companies, the people at the very top were described by workers consistently as humble. He was stunned. Jim Collins, he's a secular academic. He wasn't looking for any sort of moral or Christian principle.
But he had the data. Yeah.
And he said it was this unusual blend he found in all 11 top executives of these top companies, a double barrel characteristic of professional will and personal humility. And so he said these people were incredibly iron-willed. When they saw a good thing, they went for it, and you couldn't change their mind, and they were unbelievable. But in terms of dealing with human beings, always putting the other first, gentle, caring, and these were not qualities he expected.
Well, you wouldn't, would you, when you look around at much corporate life, be it Australia or elsewhere?
I know. I mean, the interesting thing is we would put emphasis on the great sort of egomaniac CEO. And the interesting thing is there's an illusion that takes place. The only reason you're hearing about the egomaniac CEO is because they did rise to the top, sure, but they also pushed themselves forward into the media, so we hear about them and we think they're the truly greats. But actually there are people who are outperforming them.
Good point.
Over and over, who aren't putting themselves forward, so you don't hear about them. So it's simply an illusion that we think of the great egomaniac CEO as the only way you can become powerful and great and successful. It's just not true. The research is against it.
Great point. On Open House, we're with John Dixon, who's the director for the Center for Public Christianity, author of the book Humilitas. This is the first in our four-part series looking at the whole thing of humility. John, personally, you recently met a great scholar, a bit of a hero of yours in Europe, and that meeting bears on this topic. Tell us about that.
Well, when I was filming a documentary on the life of Jesus, I got to interview about 12 of the leading scholars in this field, some of whom are Christian, some were Jews, some of no faith at all. But they are all leading academics, full professors in the leading universities in the world. So I was a kid in a candy shop, as you can imagine. But, you know, I'll be honest with you and say that a few of the interviews, I won't name names here, were a little bit disappointing because, yeah, sure, I thought they were great, but so did they think they were great.
Yeah, I know. Done a few of them myself.
And it's kind of deflating. And there's something interesting in that about how we now appreciate humility, because we're disgusted when we find our heroes are actually really arrogant. Yeah. Anyway, but one person does stand out, you're right. He's a guy called Richard Baucom. He's a professor at St Andrews University in Scotland, one of the leading universities in Europe. And he's now at Cambridge University, actually, which is also another leading European university.
Yes.
And so when I turn up with the film crew for this interview, that was really a choice interview because this guy's fluent in 8 languages. He's written more than 30 books. He's hundreds of peer review articles. He's a freak. So I was really looking forward to meeting him. And he was so instantly gracious and took us, we were quite taken aback with him, to the point where actually he asked the whole crew, so we're talking lighting guy, sound guy, you know, camera one, camera two, etc., if we wanted tea and coffee. And we thought he was going to get one of the maids of the university to make it, but he went and made it himself.
Classic.
Which you could say is a normal thing, of course, you'd do that. But when you're talking about one of the leading academics in the world,
I don't do tea.
Yeah. And he came back having made it all himself, handed it out, you know, was very chatty, was more interested in us than we were in him. Or at least that's the kind of, you know, he wasn't conscious that he was the star. And it was just very, very striking to come away having met a hero and think, wow, the guy's humble.
You are drawn to it, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is the thing. It was probably a few months later, I was back at my desk doing some academic research and trying to get to the bottom of a pretty difficult technical problem that I won't bore listeners with. And I was reading several, you know, of these scholarly works, trying to get to the bottom of it. Anyway, I just found myself reading Richard Baucom's book. And for some reason, I was incredibly persuaded by what he was saying.
How rude.
And it was only sort of hours into the research that I realized I was completely biased toward whatever Richard Baucom said.
Yep.
And I was thinking, what's going on here? But what was going on?
I like the guy.
Yeah, he gave me the impression he would never lead me down the garden path. He was trustworthy, measured, had the interest of readers in mind instead of his own fame, and I trusted him. I trusted him. It wasn't just that I'd met him, because I'd met several of the other scholars who were also, you know, their books were on my desk at the time. It was that he seemed so trustworthy, and it was his humility that gave that impression. And so, I mean, I didn't give up all academic objectivity at that point, but I did find myself thinking, we are more attracted to, persuaded by, willing to follow the humble than anyone else.
How instructive. Here's the question, though. Do you think Australians prize or cherish humility?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Obviously, our tall poppy syndrome.
Yeah.
Is, you know, it's such a key part of our culture. And part of that is a hatred of those who think highly of themselves.
Sure.
And it kind of comes from our convict origins. So, you know, when you're a convict, anyone who thinks they're uppity, especially if they've been a convict, but now they're, you know, running the show and, yeah, and they're really arrogant, we hate it. So we chop them down. But when great and powerful people are actually really kind and other person-centered and corporately minded, we love it and cherish it. So that is built into our culture, very much an appreciation of humility. At the same time, we are known throughout the world, I'm afraid, for being rather arrogant, because we are patriotic in a really weird way, in that we will talk up at our sporting teams and our weather and our beaches in a way that makes the Brits and the Americans and the Canadians just go, "Will you shut up?" So we have two selves. We have the humble self and we have the arrogant self. It's there in the human heart and we can't get rid of it.
Yeah. Do you think as the world, certainly the Western world, moves in more into more of a post-Christian era, do you think the status of humility might change again?
It's an interesting question and it's hard for me to predict, but I guess all I can say is before the Christian worldview, which said at the heart of reality is a God who empties himself for you, humility was not prized. It came to be prized in Western culture when Western culture was shaped by this story of the God of infinite power who emptied himself for us. But now that that story is marginalized, I can't help feeling that our love for humility is less logically grounded now. If you don't have a belief that at the heart of the universe is a servant king, then it's pretty hard to argue for humility. Because, yes, you know, the whole survival of the fittest mentality that says only the strong are going to survive and that's how the way it should be isn't a very good basis for humility.
No. So the full title of your book is Humilitas, A Lost Key to Life, Love and Leadership. Over the next 3 weeks, we'll look in detail at each one of those three categories. Can you give us a quick snapshot of each one of those?
Well, life, I think humility will enhance your own personal life and development.
Yep.
And I think there's a very clear argument for that. Love, it enhances relationships with those we care about. And the more humble you are toward those that you care about, the more you will enhance that relationship. And leadership, yeah, look, the bottom line is we will follow the great and powerful leader we know has our interests in mind. And when we think the leader doesn't have our interests in mind, we don't want to follow them. So there's where humility counts.
Yeah. Very much look forward to love this chat. Just as we leave you tonight, tell us your favourite story about humility.
Oh, there are so many, but yeah, probably these three lads that hopped on a bus in America some years ago and tried to pick a fight with the man at the back of the bus, not realizing who he was. And he eventually stood up. And this is after, you know, minutes of them trying to pick a fight with him and insult him. And he was giant. But he reached into his pocket and gave them his business card and then hopped off the bus, right, and went on his way without saying anything. And they gathered around the business card and read the words, "Joe Lewis, professional boxer." They had tried to pick a fight with the man who would be heavyweight boxing champion, wow, for I think 11 years.
Yes.
And was one of, is in fact listed officially as the greatest fighter of all time, Muhammad Ali's number two. He was a man of incredible power who withheld his power for the sake of others.
Just as well for them.
Just as well for them. But the beautiful thing is, apparently Joe Lewis, as I looked into his story more, was very other person-centered. He used to give away his prize money He used to be found on Detroit streets looking for people to give $20 bills to. Wow. He paid back the city of Detroit all the welfare checks his family had received because he could do it, and he wanted to give back. It's an extraordinary thing.
Beautiful story. Which is why I look forward so much to our next few interviews over the next few weeks. John Dixon, thanks as always.
Lovely to be with you.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.